Hello, are we still there?
Hello.
Sorry,
I
thought
hear
I'd start
you.
The recording.
Jane is still here. I'm here.
Yeah, I thought I would start the recording since it sounded like Karen was about to tell us things that we might want to record for posterity.
There might be something.
So go ahead, Karen.
Uh-oh. We may have lost Karen.
Oh, dear.
She may not have pressed her one in time. I think it's
maybe she'll give it another shot.
Yeah,
I'm guessing she will. It shouldn't have hung up on her or anything. So what else is new?
What else is new? Nothing on my end.
Yeah, likewise here. I came in for some inspiration and to get updated on where everybody's at and what I can do is share with you my daughter's presenting at AGU, so hopefully she'll get to go to. Yeah, she was on an NSF REU. In Texas this past summer, looking at oxygen isotope ratios and stalagmite type stuff in the caves in Texas.
Cool.
So she's at the undergrad level and is sort of making moves this direction.
Excellent, excellent. We had our first workshop for teachers for our Marcellus Educator. Marcella Shale Educator Professional Development this Saturday. And that was interesting and I think good, and I think all of the participants found it interesting and worth their time and a good kickoff to what's going to be an 8-month program with this cohort of a dozen educators from the Elmira area. And the educators include classroom teachers as well as folks from Science Museum and Nature Center that are in Elmira, and probably
that'll be a nice combination.
Yeah, we're trying to get them to think about how populations in one venue that they serve can serve populations in the other venues that they serve, and do a community-wide effort. And I think there's interest in one of the final products being a public seminar or something like that. And in the Marcellus Shale, which what we had built into the grant project was that the closing thing for this group would be the introduction for the next cohort, which we'll bring in from another community and then do everything else in that other community where there's emergent energy issues, which may or may not be Marcellus Shale, but will probably be Marcellus Shale, but it could be wind farms or the siting of a new power plant or something like that. So it was a good start. I think part of the idea is to use the Marcellus as a case study for helping develop strategies and materials for education and outreach related to emergent energy issues so that communities hopefully won't be as blindsided as we felt we were by the Marcellus Shale.
I was going to say, tell me a little bit more about the Marcellus Shale. Is gas in the shale?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, if you were in the
so
Northeast, you would know.
Are we talking fracking? Are we...
Yes, we are talking about the process of hydraulic fracturing and its costs and benefits and consequences and in the way they ripple across a range of systems trying to figure out if it's better or worse than things that we do now is really a fundamental question that it's a very, very polarizing issue.
I bet it is. And what you probably don't know, I actually taught in Campbell which is west of Elmira.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yep. I taught there for 7 years.
What do you know?
Back at the beginning of my career, yes. So I'm familiar with Elmira, and I'm familiar with the Corning area. And I actually visited one of the power plants there and did a slideshow on it back when I was teaching school.
There are no longer any power plants in Chemung, Tyler, or Steuben counties. So they're bringing all their energy in from the surrounding area, all of their electricity, that is. There was a coal-fired power plant.
I'm remembering a coal-fired power plant. So that's off now, eh?
Yeah, that's off. Yep.
Yep. Yeah. Well, I'm very interested to hear that. Development and.
Yeah. Well, maybe in the spring I'll do a telecon on it for this group.
I just want to add, I went to Don's presentation at the NAAEE conference, and I assume that's a major part, Don, of of what. Yeah. And what I found super about it is that it presents all the data so that you say to yourself, oh, it's not just a black and white simple issue.
Sure is not.
And I think that's the kind of complex education we need to be doing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's our 21st century skills piece.
Yep.
That's right. Yeah, the soundbite that I've come to, derived from rubbing my nose in the energy system for the last year or so, is that as educators, we tend to want to simplify the seemingly complex. And in the case of the energy system and the Marcellus Shale, and I think quite a number of other things, what we need to be doing is complexifying the seemingly simple.
Yep.
It's such, and people hear two sentences about the Marcellus Shale, and they make up their mind, and then they stick with that decision with all their might.
Yes.
And it's really just way, way more complex than that.
Yep.
So, well, Karen's back.
I don't know whether I deleted myself or what, but I thought, oh, that was rude.
We're glad to have a period,
and I'm gone.
We were kind of waiting until we heard back from you, Karen.
So I started the record not remembering that it sort of pauses the discussion when you start the recording for everybody to go press their one. And we pressed our ones, and you were gone.
Don, before we move back to Karen, because I think what Karen has to say is a good thing to share, too, is I have a question which you may or may not know the answer to.
Mm-hmm.
With fracking, there's I've been reading more and more of where they're talking about an increased number of earthquakes, especially like in Oklahoma.
Yes.
And they're actually suggesting that it has to do with some of the fracking issues and such. Have you heard anything? Is there anything more than just, earthquakes happen and this is a coincidence? Or
It's not. There is induced seismicity from injecting lots of fluid into the ground. Whether the earthquakes in Oklahoma are a result of hydraulic fracturing is, I think, still an open question right now. Probably not the big ones. The earthquakes the seismic events that result from hydraulic fracturing, the ones that have been clearly connected so far to hydraulic fracturing have all been around a magnitude 3 or less that I'm aware of, which means that you might be able to feel them, but they're not going to do any damage. So, but there is indeed induced seismicity is the label for it, and we actually have one of my colleagues at the museum has written a pamphlet. We're writing a series of pamphlets. I think we've got 8 out now on issues related to hydraulic fracturing in the Marcellus Shale, and one of them is on induced seismicity, which I haven't read in a few months since it came out. And I didn't write it, so I'm not an expert on it. But yes, there is a connection. There was certainly no connection to the Washington area earthquake last in the spring or whenever that was. But I don't know enough about the Oklahoma earthquakes to know if there's a potential connection there. But I have nephews that live there.
And they sent me the some newspaper articles which were about it, and of course they were questioning what was causing it. And basically it sounded like more data needs to be collected, and Colorado, the National Geological Survey, seems to be the prime data collectors on this one.
But I
think there is some querying going on, and we don't know the answer yet.
This morning on NPR, and I don't know whether it was a Colorado story or a national story, there's agreement from the companies that they're going to release all the chemicals that they inject.
Yeah.
As long as they're not, quote, trade secrets, unquote. So... I'm not sure the extent of that.
Yeah, well, that's a complicated issue. And in certain ways, for certain people, it's never been, the list of chemicals has never really been a super top secret the way it sounded in some reporting. Because for any industrial operation, you have to have on file with the local responders, emergency responders, material safety data sheets about what you've got on an industrial site. And the specific mixture of, you know, ratios of how much of this and how much of that have been secret, I guess. But the exact list of chemicals has never really been more than a FOIA request away. And for over a year, the Pennsylvania Department of Natural Resources has had a full list online of all the chemicals that are used. But again, you know, the exact composition, the mixture varies from site to site. And it's worth noting for those of you not from the Northeast that New York is not yet allowing slick water horizontal high volume hydraulic fracturing, and that's the mixture of technologies that's going on in a lot of other places. Most of those technologies have been around for a long, long time, but the mixture of them is relatively new. And the biggest, I think, point of concern is the phrase in their high volume, where you're using millions of gallons. To fracture a well rather than thousands of gallons, which is what's done with vertical wells and has been done for 60 years or so.
Interesting.
So one of the issues that brings to my mind is scale. And you're talking about the importance of being able to discuss these issues in a complex way.
Yep.
And part of that complexity in the whole decision-making process is scale. How big
That's
a deal
right.
is this? Does this
right.
knock off a few birds or bats? Does it knock off a whole population?
Right.
Does it knock off a whole species? And over what time scale
That's
and
right.
space scale?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of those cross-cutting things, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, and scale is a very, very important aspect of this. And we're... Right now, the limit on how much water you can use to fracture a well in New York State is, I think, 85,000 gallons. And the typical horizontal well takes 2 to 3 million gallons per well. And a well head will have typically six wells on a well pad. So that means that you're bringing in that 2 to 3 million gallons six times, and some wells can have more than a dozen, or some well pads rather can have more than a dozen. But then you also need to understand the scale of what does a million gallons mean. Well, the projected use for New York State, assuming that a hydraulic fracturing comes to pass, high slick water, high volume hydraulic fracturing comes to pass in New York State, then there will be thousands of wells with millions of gallons per well, potentially millions of gallons per well, which will mean an increased use of water of about 1% from what we're doing now for all uses.
Amazing.
And whether that's a big number or a small number depends on sort of your frame of mind. It's not going to exhaust the amount of water in the Finger Lakes or anything like that. Yeah, it's measurable, but it's only 1% of the total.
Well, then, and what that does is address how do we show data, and what's the meaning of that on with depending on what question you're asking.
That's
so
right. That's right.
For kids, and when you're learning this stuff, it's something may look big or small depending on how you say it and the context in which you say it.
Yep. That's right. That's right.
So part of it is learning to ask those kinds of scale questions.
That's right. And related to that is that the natural gas industry in North America actually started in Western New York, the first commercial gas well, some people say in the world, but the reality is that the Chinese have been using using natural gas to boil brine to make salt for something like 2,000 years using bamboo piping. But in the U.S., but in the U.S., the first commercial gas well was in Fredonia, New York in 1825, and Fredonia, which is a little college town south of Buffalo, had gas lighting on the streets and some gas lighting in homes and gas heating in houses since the 1820s. And there is still, in a different formation than the Marcellus, there is still a lot of gas production in Western New York. And in fact, one of the things that I did in Saturday's workshop was show a Google map that shows the location of the over 5,000 wells that are in Chautauqua County, which is one county with 5,000 wells, which, you know, if you, depending on how you look at that, if you look at a Google map where there's a push pin for each well and you're zoomed out to the extent of the county, you can't see anything but the push pins. But if you zoom in, it looks like rural upstate New York, because it is rural upstate New York, and you can find the access roads and such if you're looking for them, there's already a gas industry here, and the gas industry started here, it's almost invisible to most people because it's one little pipe sticking out of the ground once the well is drilled and such with some infrastructure around it. And people don't think much of it, and it's a very different look to it than a coal mine, for example. And there aren't any commercial coal mines in New York State. I don't think there's any coal to speak of in New York State because it's all eroded away before humans got here. And so New York's been either very lucky or very evil, depending on how you look at it, in terms of externaling most of the environmental costs of our energy use.
Right.
We don't have coal mines. We don't have much in the way of oil production. We don't have any uranium mines, which is where we get an awful lot of our electricity from. So now that it's coming to town in a new way, in a more explicit way. A lot of people are worried about it, and rightfully so. But if you're going to be opposed to hydraulic fracturing, you have to think about what that means you're for.
And, right.
If you're just flat out opposed to it, but not thinking about changing lifestyles and changing the way that municipalities deal with energy and such, then I think you need to rethink your position.
Exactly. So there's no free lunch. There is.
That's
no
right.
Free
actually,
lunch.
The name of my talk was "There's No Such Thing as a Free Megawatt," which I'll be doing at NSCA.
Very nice.
As well. Yeah.
I'm so sorry. I wasn't able to see your presentation. I'm thinking about some of the work that was done by Rocky Mountain Institute, the megawatt type things, and energy efficiency, and how much can be saved on the demand side rather than just on the production side also.
Yeah.
So I bet you your stuff includes that as an option, doesn't it?
It surely does, yeah. And I think sort of the we've promised the NSF, who is funding our we've got three separate grants related to Marcellus Shale education and outreach, all from NSF, and we've essentially promised them that we will not take a position for or against hydraulic fracturing. But the more you look at the energy system, the more you recognize that there is no such thing as a free megawatt except for the ones that aren't used. it's, you know, I've been working on this for about a year now, and the more I look at it, the more I recognize that the bigger question is not what kinds of energy sources to look at or to develop, but rather how to use a whole lot less energy. And when you use a whole lot less energy, it makes a lot less difference where it comes from.
It takes the pressure off. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we need to drop our energy use by an order of magnitude, which I don't think means the end of industrialized society. I think it just means we need to figure out how to do certain things differently and how to do how to find some things to do instead of the things that we're doing right now, like traveling to conferences, for example, which I think we can come up with alternatives to that are pedagogically and scientifically or whatever just as productive. But it'll take some creative thinking.
I have to tell you about the newest exhibit at the National Research Council.
Okay.
Have you been there, Don, in one of your trips?
I have not been there lately.
They had a previous climate change exhibit, but the new one has a simulation on it where you push bars up and down to get your mix of what you would propose doing to reduce greenhouse gas generation in the United States. And then you're asked, once you've gotten your reduction set, by choices on, let me go back a step. The choices you have are energy efficiency, transportation efficiency, carbon sequestration, nuclear generation, air pollution, or cleaner air, and preservation of habitat. And on those five slide bars, you can slide any of them as much or as little as you want. And I'm assuming, just because it's at the NRC, that their program has factored in all the models that we know of today. And what I was surprised about, having just been out in California and read their press about their current initiatives, which have to do with producing, I think it's a 50% reduction by 2050, but I could be wrong about that. They're talking about building umpteen nuclear power plants every month, and I can't remember the exact number. But when I set these slide bars at the NRC this weekend, you can use virtually no nuclear energy and achieve it by what you're just describing, by efficiency, by in both energy production and use and transportation, and improving air quality and preserving habitats. And a modest amount of carbon sequestration, and reduce U.S. Generation of greenhouse gases 50% by 2050. And then if you on the next set of decisions, if you choose the same reduction level for the world, a 50% reduction by 2050.
Wow.
you can get a pretty straight line going across
mm-hmm.
for future years.
Yep.
And that really surprised me. But what that simulation did was it enabled people to look at the complexities and do predictions, generate, you know, outcomes, predicted outcomes. And I think those kinds of, you know, what is the right mix that we should be pursuing kinds of questions really are important.
And I think the simulation is a really wonderful way to deal with the complexity. I did want to share with you, I have not been to that one, but there was a similar climate change display model similar to this that was making the rounds of museums in New England. And I think that kind of modeling is really wonderful because you do get intellectual feedback for what are the variety of outcomes that happen when you shift those
levels. As long as it's grounded in sound modeling. And
yes.
That's
and best evidence.
That's why I felt it was important that the NRC had generated this.
Yes.
I probably wouldn't have spent more than 2 seconds at it if it hadn't been at the NRC.
Right.
And that's just my bias, you know, but I believe that they would have done that.
What's exciting about that, too, is it's on a national level and a global level.
Yep.
Did it have population tied in, too?
I don't remember it doing that. I was only there probably for half hour, 45 minutes, and then I needed
okay.
to go somewhere else. So
right.
I didn't explore all the panels, but there were several other panels around the room that I didn't get to.
Okay. That
but,
sounds,
you know, it's reaching a
great.
Very it's be, reaching a very skewed part of the population.
People who drive
my yes.
say.
Yeah. the choir.
Great. Well, Karen, do you want to tell us about your day last Thursday?
Well, it was very exciting. We had, and I learned a lot both about the technology that we used and about people's perceptions of what an assessment framework is. On the technology side, we had over 600 people register in advance for the event, both in person and as a webcast. And we had probably 60 out of the 80 people that had registered for the in-person event at the National Press Club show up, and somewhere around 300 show up online out of the 500 and some odd who had registered for that. So what I learned is that if you start registration a month out, you have drop-off just like you do for in-person events. And I learned that the technology is still not universal, as Don well knows, and that
really?
You run into people who have glitches who can't connect for one reason or another. Their systems just don't connect. We went to the press club for two reasons. One, to be on neutral ground so that it would not be on one agency's turf. And two, so that we wouldn't have to deal with federal security regulations. And both those reasons for that decision ended up being absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Well,
and we got people there from every agency. National Research Council was there, NSF, NOAA, EPA, I'm forgetting a couple. But anyway, the whole schmear
yeah.
was
nice.
And Karen, I thought that the other thing was, it was exciting about it. I mean, National Press Club is always sort of like, it's a big ticket thing, you know, it's got cachet, where if you did it from, you know, the auditorium at, you know, it's got, you know, doesn't have nearly the cachet.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really exciting. I mean, I was glad to see Martin there from
NRC. Yeah.
That was very exciting to see.
Yep. Yep. And they're struggling a lot with how do you frame what environmental literacy is and what do we need to be doing? And so that's what our work for the last year has been about. And in talking to the press for the week in advance of the event and even NAAEE members, we found out that we had to really simplify our work and our products to even begin to explain clearly to people what we'd done. So what we did was we explained and presented our definition of environmental literacy, and we presented the other two products. In addition to a definition, we identified the competencies and other components, which include knowledge and dispositions, that go together to make up environmental literacy. And we presented the framework that we have proposed for PISA 2015, because the PISA Governing Board and the contractor for PISA 2015 are presently developing an assessment for environmental literacy that will be an optional part of the regular PISA in 2015. And all that stuff is on the website, and you can take as quick a look or as long a look as you want.
Thank you.
OAEE site?
Yes, it's at naaee.net, and then a slash, I don't know how you say this, a slash that goes from the bottom to the top, forward.
Yep, forward.
Do you call that forward slash?
Yep. The regular slash is the forward slash.
Okay, framework. Just the one word, framework. naaee.net/framework.
There you go. I am there.
Great.
Awesome.
And there are a lot of exciting discussions going on, which is the other, to add on to what Boris said, the other exciting part, I believe. You folks probably know that the state governments, because of the revisions in the Elementary Secondary Education Act, are working on environmental literacy plans to qualify for federal matching funds for those. And one of the requirements for that in the current version of the legislation is to have an assessment of graduating seniors to show acquisition of environmental literacy. And so the level of interest on the part of these states is huge. And we're going to have another conference call this Thursday to discuss the implications for this and next steps and what people are doing to move this work forward. And then, of course, the whole PISA contractor and the environmental literacy expert group in OECD is moving forward with that. So there are both international and I wouldn't say national assessments, but at least state consortia, perhaps, that will be looking at this and hopefully moving it forward. And there are agencies that are interested in funding it here nationally, so that's exciting as well.
It's good stuff.
Yeah. Exciting. Moving things off the dime.
Yeah.
One question that somebody has brought up who hasn't tuned in much depth to this said, well, you know, don't we need to decide to do just social marketing for some people? And so the whole debate on who needs to be environmentally literate is, I believe, one of the next steps. You know, defining what environmentally friendly behavior is and then doing social marketing so that people pick up litter and recycle things and turn down the thermostat is one thing, but that is nowhere near what environmental literacy is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason why in this country we get into trouble is we blur the lines between those two approaches. And I don't think a social marketing campaign is environmental literacy.
Right.
And I think we've really got to be careful about that.
Well, and Karen, you may remember this, that it goes back to like 96, 97, mm-hmm. 95.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little NAAE publication, which probably
yes.
isn't available anymore, that was kind of a, what is EE and what is social marketing and the difference? And it was, you know, Lori Mann wrote it, but it was kind of that, you know, interview between the, there's these people, the Academy for Educational Development out of D.C. that do a huge amount of social marketing on everything from
saving
HIV
water
AIDS.
In Egypt. Yeah.
Yeah, saving water in Egypt and HIV AIDS and, you know, condom use. I mean, it's sort of all over the board, but they do social marketing. And it was really trying to make the distinction of that they have different methodologies and they have different purposes because it really is towards a specific, you know, it's a specific behavior that they're after.
I was going to say that's a specific behavior which
Correct.
Is different from affecting how people think, how people make decisions.
And
exactly.
the competencies that are needed to do that.
Yes.
Right, yeah. And, you know, I always thought that that was a really nice, clearly done
Yep.
Little publication. I probably couldn't get my hands on it anymore.
And this person that was talking to me more recently pointed out that Martha Monroe had an article in Human Ecology Review in 2003 that does something similar, Bora, to that publication that you're just describing.
Right. But it is, I mean, it's the classic issue that we have around environmental ed or
yep.
any of this. You know, whether, Don, it's the stuff that you were talking about, you know, there's the classic group of folks who, you know, just want to give the science facts or just
yeah.
want to, and be agnostic, as someone recently right. said, on, you know, the decision-making and the skills that are involved with that and call that environmental literacy or the nature-oriented stuff. So it's like, oh, all we have to do is get them out into nature and then they will be big black box, you know. And, you know, and I think that, you know, the social marketing folks, you know, it's that same sort of like, well, wouldn't, you know, if we just did some ad campaigns, wouldn't that be good enough? You know.
Well, and it's the desire to urgently deal with this crisis, you know.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
Let's have a quick fix.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know,
yeah.
if we could just get people to, you know, use the condom equivalent of energy, you know, on energy,
yeah.
then wouldn't it be wonderful? You know?
I love it.
You know, I started out thinking that about 30
Boy,
years ago. I was going to put together the little holiday gift that had all of those things in it, you know, the little water-saving thing for your toilet and for your shower and for a roll of insulation, you know. What are
An
the
environmental
things
condom just for you.
Yes, 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 yes. Now that would be some marketing, eh?
Exactly.
But, you know, people have come to me, neighbors and folks, saying, Jane, just tell me what to do. And I think the message is, we don't tell you what to do, what to think. We tell you how. And, Bora,
well,
I think you actually said that at one of the meetings that we were at. And it's more like how to think, and it's a lot harder than just giving people the mantra of 50 things to save the earth, you know?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
well, and that
well,
builds off of, yeah, classic stuff in EE, so.
Yeah, and it, you know, it needs to be community and community-wide and bigger
right.
for really very much impact.
Yeah, because the politicians are never going to be able to make the wise decisions if the public isn't there.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Okie dokie. Well, it sounds like there are four of us who are not at AGU today. But a good group
it's been
it
a pleasure. It's yeah. been a pleasure. Thanks, you all.
Yeah. Anybody else have any highlights to share of things going
no.
on in the world? No. Okay.
I think we've got the tiger by the tail right here, the four of us.
we can solve the world's problems, I'm sure.
There we go. There we go.
There is power in small groups.
Right. Well, thank
well,
you, Don, for organizing this.
Call it a wrap?
Yep.
Oh, well,
thank you for hosting us.
Sure yeah. thing. I actually got the recording to work this time, which pleases
Yay.
Me.
Good job.
Yeah. Well, I think the problem was calling in from Skype wouldn't allow the buttons to work, so I actually called in from my phone. Normally, the participant, I'm on Skype.
Yes, as we learned last week, there are things in technology that don't mesh with the other systems.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Well, it's a good thing we're lifelong learners, folks.
That's right.
Right.
That's the truth.
It's been a pleasure.
Right.
Thanks. Thanks very much, all of you.
Yep.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.